If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Here we go. Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn. I'm your host. My guest today is Joe Templin. He calls himself a reformed physicist, financial planner, startup founder, and autodidactic polymath. That best described as a Swiss Army knife. Whew. Say that three times fast. Joe Templin has invested the past 2.5+ decades to helping others reach their financial potential as a planner, trainer, mentor, and creator. Joe has served as a member of NAFA, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, on the local, state, and national level, and including 3 terms on the NAFA National Young Advisors Team Subcommittee, and was honored as one of the 2011 Four Under 40. He's a graduate of the Leadership and Life Institute of NAFA, as well as Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and is an alum of Johns Hopkins University. Joe earned his CFP and has written hundreds of review questions for the exam. He has been a business columnist for the Albany Times Union, Advisor Today magazine, and Insurance News Net. Joe earned his certified executive counselor designation, as well as his certified master executive counselor in 2021. Joe is currently a vice president of the Autism Society of the Greater Capital Region. He is also the managing director of the Unique Minds Consulting Group, and is the author of Everyday Excellence, the Kindle #1 new release in professional development. Joe is a co-founder and president of the Intro Machine, Inc., an organization dedicated to teaching professionals in a variety of fields how to build an introduction-based business. He has spoken all across the U.S. and Canada on ethical business development. In his free time, I don't know where he gets that from, Joe enjoys running ultra marathons, crazy guy, and is a fourth Don from the Kokikwan in Seoul, Korea. I don't know what that is. And former international champion. He lives in Gainesport, New York, with his hooligan boys, Danny, Liam, and Colin. They're huge Yankee fans. Please help me welcome Joe Templin.
Oh my God. I didn't realize you were going to read all that. I thought you'd just like make up something, make it sound like I've done something in my life.
Yeah, well, you know what? I wasn't going to read all that, but I need to fill some airspace. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Airtime?
I'll try and be slightly amusing.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't worry about it if I were you.
All right.
Okay, how are you, Joe?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good.
Getting Thank better?
You. Always better. Always gets better.
You know what? That's American optimism right there. Love it.
There you go. There you go. Okay. Now, as you know, the name of this podcast is Whispers and Bricks. Whispers are those voices telling us what the right thing to do is, and they represent the good in life. The bricks represent the bad things we go through in life, and let's be real, everybody has bricks thrown at them at some point in time or another in their lifetime. Some more bricks, some less bricks, some bigger, some smaller. Now, there's
some reasons. You should take those bricks and build a castle out of them.
There you go.
And then you can, like, you know, defend it and get rid of the bad guys.
There you go. I don't know why I didn't think of that. There were several reasons why I asked you to be my guest on the show. After our initial conversation, I knew there were people in my audience who were going through some of the same things that you were going through. They had been hit with brick after brick, much like what you had gone through, and they needed to hear and to know that they could get through the trials and tribulations the same way that you did. They needed to know that there were whispers out there that could save them. Now, in your life, you've had many bricks thrown at you, but let's start with a little background info. To start with, your mom was a nun,
yep,
and your dad was a military man,
yep,
but they had 6 kids.
Six of us survived. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So my mom was a farm kid. She was the youngest of 7 growing up in upstate New York. And my dad went to RPI, which is part of the reason I ended up there. He started in 1958 because of Sputnik, when the U.S. government decided to start putting a lot more investment into technology to beat the Russians. So my dad went on ROTC scholarship to RPI, graduated, got commissioned as a butter bar in the U.S. Army infantry. And then 3 months later was the Bay of Pigs incident.
Whoa. Okay.
And then that started to ramp up with this little thing called Vietnam.
Yeah, I remember that well.
Yeah. So that's, you know, my mom and dad met on a blind date arranged by my mom's older sister, who's my godmother, and her boyfriend, who was my dad's fraternity big brother. They went on a blind date. They dated a whole bunch of times. Then my mom decided, screw this, I'm going into the convent.
Oh. So she was dating first, and then she became a nun. I thought she was a nun and then left.
No,
the
then she came out of the convent, started dating my dad again.
How long was she in the convent?
I don't know. This is before I was born, so
obviously.
And now that most of my aunts and uncles have passed on, I can't get the right story anywhere.
Okay.
But then, like, they got engaged. She gives the ring back, goes back into the convent. She was in the convent like 2 or 3 times. I think it was 3 is what Sister Margaret said. And eventually Sister Margaret's like, you're going to marry John. And she ended up marrying my dad. And there's 6 of us. And, you know, they lived happily ever after until my mom eventually developed cancer from smoking 2 packs a day, probably from dealing with 6 kids, and ended up passing on about 8 years ago.
And how old was she when she passed on?
She was 73.
73. All right. Well, I think let's go back to, I think this was the first major brick that you got hit with was at the age of 10, when you were, as you said, quote unquote, legally dead from asthma. Can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, there were lots of bricks leading up to that with the various asthma attacks, because back in the early 1970s, I mean, they didn't have the puffers that they have now and all that. So if you were having an asthma attack, you needed like a shot of adrenaline, or, you know, they would do one of those things where they were basically blowing adrenaline and steroids directly into your lungs, and then they'd stick you in an oxygen tent for a week and all that. So I was having a real bad asthma attack. I was 10 years old. We go see Doc Murray. I'm laying there on the examination table, and all of a sudden I no longer had a tight chest, and I'm floating on up, and there's the big light and everything. I'm looking down. Doc Murray becomes like an octopus with all these arms, and he's like going like this, and my mom's freaking out. And I heard, you know, the big deep voice, it's not yet time. And then I was back down my body and, you know, having trouble breathing and off to the hospital.
Wow. Wow. So you saw the bright light.
Yeah, I saw the bright light. And that's part of the reason why I'm like this today. No, not completely insane. That's from other things. But because, you know, if you get a second chance like that, and this is one of the things that, you know, I'd love to hear about your story a little bit on this. When you get that second chance at life, you don't waste it. I mean, we get 86,400 seconds a day. It doesn't matter if you're Bill Gates or a kid in college, you get the same amount, and you can't like bank some for next week when, you know, you're going to need them. So I, as my friends say, burn the candle at both ends and in the middle. And so I accomplish more typically in 1 year than most people do in a decade. And that's just the way it is, because I'm nonstop.
Wow. Wow. Well, I do know that you were an underachiever because you started college at the ripe old age of 13.
Right. Because my parents said 12 was too young to start college.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you were an underachiever. 13 years old, you started college. Well, I mean, what was... How did that come about? Like, were you just bored in school? Did they?
Well, there was partially that. Yeah. And so like my mom actually refused to tell me what my IQ scores ever were, but I found out that they were, you know, the first digit that I saw was a 2. So I used to be wicked smart. But I told my mom when I was like 8 years old that I wanted to learn everything that there was to know. And she's like, well, you better get started, you know? So to this day, I have that attitude. And that's part of the reason why I'm an autodidactic polymath, is that I get fascinated by everything, whether it's finance, physics, psychology. So I am a sponge when it comes to learning. And a lot of things have come from that. It made me a very good intelligence officer. It's helped me as a writer. Makes me always, you know, everyone's first choice at trivia night in the pub. So I've learned and just had this absolute desire to experience and learn things from even before I had the encounter, as we'll call it. And so that's carried forward in a lot of ways. So the Johns Hopkins University was introducing a special program in the 1980s, which we nicknamed Genius Camp. And I was one of the first people in upstate New York to be involved with it, with my Irish twin, my older brother, Jay. And so at 13 years old, I was taking college classes.
So what was it like being Sheldon?
It's funny saying that, because then later on I went into applied physics. So everybody's like, oh, you know, the Big Bang Theory, that's like you, Templar. And I have never actually seen an entire episode of that.
Yeah, well.
Even though it's funny because it's true, GIF is my favorite GIF to use on other people.
Yeah. So just to veer off a little bit, what was it like? I mean, you're 13 years old, you're going to college. I mean, with guys that are 18, 19, 20, how did you?
I'd always been exposed to people who were older because my mom was the youngest and she had us when she was relatively older. So my cousins were all 5, 8, 15 years older than me. So I grew up with them as my models, not always necessarily good models. But I mean, my mom said that when I was like 2 years old and she was teaching my cousin, helping her with her high school biology homework, I was dancing around singing about deoxyribonucleic acid, and my cousin wanted to strangle me. And then later on, that cousin was actually head of the science department at the high school I went to. So that sort of laid the groundwork. Like I designed an atomic bomb when I was 11 years old, maybe I was 12. And I asked my mom if she could get me any radioactive material because she was a former radiation biologist. She wanted to know why. I explained. So of course she said no. I wanted to get a chemistry set. She's like, okay, you need to take high school chemistry first. So I took high school chemistry, did really well. I'm like, where's my chemistry set? She's like, you need to take AP Chem before I do that. I'm like, all right. So I took AP Chemistry. I got 5 on the exam. I'm like, where's my chemistry set? She's like, you're too dangerous now. So of course I ended up going into physics and working for the government designing weapons. So this is what happens if you don't give your kid a chemistry set. He goes and builds atomic bombs and stuff like that. So warning to the parents. It's like that scene from NCIS where Gibbs is, you know, back seeing his dad, and his dad wouldn't let him take the rifle when he was a kid. So he ended up becoming a Navy sniper. It's just like that. Give your kids the chemistry set, all right? Or else they're going to get a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook and then go and be an intel officer.
All right. Let's fast forward. Now you have 3 children, two of whom are actually special needs.
Yes.
Tell us, you know, that must have been very interesting, you know, trying to raise 3 kids, 2 of whom are special needs. You must have acquired some kind of, you know, skills that most parents would not have acquired. Tell us what it was like. Tell us what you did. Tell us, you know, how you dealt with it.
Well, before my mom died, and this was before my youngest or either of them were diagnosed as autistic, I used to call her up and I'd be like, Mom, I'm so sorry. And she's like, which one and what'd they do this time? Because, you know, she used to say that she would curse me with one just like myself, and I got 3 of them. So there is that going on. So my youngest was diagnosed first, and he was diagnosed with autism and ADHD simultaneously, and he had horrible eyesight, so he could like barely see, and he had sensory issues. So in kindergarten, first grade, it was like having a drunk toddler in Vegas with the overstimulation. And it, like every time I turned around, I was getting a call from the school. I have to come pick him up. He ran from a bus. You know, he got thrown out for a day for throwing rocks at a kid. He got thrown out 3 summer programs in a 1 week and a half week period because of just having this uncontrollable not just energy, but in an ability to relate to other individuals. And so we got him diagnosed, and then that was actually a great thing, because once we know what's wrong, or not wrong, but why he's different, because he's not wrong, he's just different. Himself. He's, yeah. You know, he says he's a mutant. He has superpowers, so I go with that. He does have some, you know, incredible intellectual abilities. So, but then we were able to start dealing with it. We were able to get the school social worker. We were starting to learn strategies. I reached out to autistic communities. I talked with one of my friends who's a highly successful physicist and executive, and he's got a son, and so he was in many ways my mentor through this. So when I was having bad days, I could call him, and when he was having bad days, Jason would call me, and we would be able to support each other on this. So that's one of the things in the special needs community, whether it's neurological special needs like mine, or I've got a friend whose son had a rare form of pediatric cancer, or the parent who's got kids have diabetes, finding your tribe, your support group, that you guys can swap stories and ideas and, you know, shoulders, is a major, major thing. So my Cub Scout pack, I'd say a quarter of my kids are special needs in some capacity. So some of the things that I've learned over time, I actually sit down with the parents. I'm like, hey, you might want to try this. Here's an idea that, you know, we've used that has worked. And they're like, thank God for this, because one, the kids, we accept all kids. It doesn't matter how weird they are in Cub Scouts. And some of them are really weird, and there's no excuse. They're just strange kids, but that's awesome. We still love them, but it gives the kids peers and kids who are a little bit older that they can model off of. Because this, like with my kids, my youngest and my oldest are on the spectrum. My oldest can be highly disruptive, to say the least. And so my youngest models off of him. So having other kids a year or two ahead of him, 3 years ahead of him, that he can see and have a different path that he can walk because of that, is a very good thing. So any of your listeners who have children that are on the spectrum or have these emotional support needs, I would recommend that they find organizations like that or groups like that, where the kids can see better influences, better behavior, whether it's the older kids or the leadership around it, so that they can have this image of this is the better way overall. So in terms of strategies, one of the strategies that I picked up from Jason that I've applied with my youngest son, and actually I apply in business all the time, I teach my clients, is playing the what if game. Because with autistic kids, they very often have this checklist in their head of how things are going to go. They write their narrative, which is part of the reason why some of them don't like to read fiction, because the plot twists throw a wrench in their works. And if something does not go the way that they have scripted in their head, that's part of the time that they have big meltdowns and some of the issues. So what I did with my son is we learned to play the what if game. So we're going to go to your favorite restaurant on your birthday, buddy. What are we going to do if they're closed? What if they are closed? What's the backup plan? And he helps develop that plan. So he's buying in. So he has emotional invested interest in it. Okay, Da, if Sunset's closed, we're going to go to Henry's. All right, good. Now, what if we go to Sunset and you wanted to have nachos, you said, your favorite food? Yes. Okay, what if they don't have nachos? What are you going to do? I'm going to do this. And so it allows him to plan out what he can do in terms of alternative paths if what he is foreseeing is not happening. And this reduces the stress and allows him to be comfortable. So if you're going on like a plane trip, or if you're planning a night out or planning something, taking a couple of minutes to sit there and play the what if game on the most likely disruptions helps reduce that stress level and helps them cope. So with my clients, my business owners, I teach them to do this. Okay, what if this sale does not go through? What if the client says X in response to your presentation? And it allows us to essentially role play alternatives beforehand so that these clients are better prepared if something comes from left field. And the origin of this actually, in some ways, goes all the way back to Sun Tzu's The Art of War. The victorious general conducts thousands of calculations in his fortress ere he marches out to battle. If you've played this game and figure out the alternatives and what could happen and what your responses are, it allows you to think two or three steps ahead, sort of like a chess grandmaster. And this way, no matter what is occurring in the situation, you are at least somewhat prepared for the outcome. And so you can control and get what you need.
It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I'm in awe. I got to be honest with you. I'm in awe. That's brilliant. Something that I think everybody could learn from. Now, when we had our time, just you and I, and we were talking, you mentioned something. You have another way of dealing with situations, and that's called the reset button.
Yes.
Tell us about the reset button.
So the reset button is actually something that we as big people can use if our day is spiraling out of control. We've all had that day where it's the absolute horrible, no good day where it starts with you spilling coffee on yourself on the commute. Maybe you have a flat tire, you know, the computer's not working properly. You get the call from, you know, disrupting things, and it's just spiraling out of control. And we need to, if it's like dominoes going out, you know, being knocked over, we need to put a hand there to stop the fall. Mm-hmm. We need to literally pause everything and be able to take a deep breath and rewind and reset. So when my youngest is having a really bad morning when he gets up, it happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. Maybe he didn't sleep well. Maybe, you know, his brothers, you know, were being jerks, which if you have older brothers, you know that they are jerks. That's part of their responsibility. You know, so whatever it is, if he's having a bad start to the day, before that can spiral out of control and he takes it to school or whatever, I literally say, all right, buddy, we're going to hit the reset button. And we go back to his room. He takes his glasses off, puts them on his nightstand, shoes off, crawls back into bed. I tuck him in real tight because a lot of kids with sensory issues like almost being swaddled like babies because it makes them comfortable. It helps them to calm down. So I swaddle him in real tight, tuck him in, turn the lights out, and I walk out. And I come back in 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, and I basically wake him up as if it's a brand new day. We've forgotten all the crap that happened in that 10, 15 minutes or half hour that I was up and, you know, being a nasty, you know, whatever. So we just play it forward from that one. I wake him up, you know, with a sweet smile. Hey, man, come on, let's get up. You know, we're running a little bit late today, but it's going to be a good day. And I just literally give him a chance to restart it with a fresh slate.
Wow. That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Let me ask you this. Was there ever a point in your life where you'd sunk like so low, you said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. It's too hard. You know, I'm giving up on my dreams. And if yes, how did you overcome?
Okay. I have to admit, I hit that point multiple times every single week because my goals are so big. When you're trying to change the world, when you're trying to, you know, break the records, be an Olympian, when you're trying to do incredible things, the world beats you down and people try and drag you down and you're trying to do things that haven't been done before. There's risk. So that means that you can fail. And if you fail over and over again, it can beat you down, especially if you got somebody chirping in your ear, blah, 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 blah. So what you need to do is, as Friedrich Nietzsche said, if the man has a strong enough why, he will overcome anyhow. So there are days when I'm like, God, can I do this again? I don't want to, or like, you know, I had a big client cancel on 5 hours notice the other day, 5 hours, supposed to give me 30 days notice, 5 hours, and saying, nope, not paying you. getting the entire month's worth of, you know, revenue gone. And then I had a couple other minor incidents that were negative, like immediately after that. And it could have literally spun me out of control. What did I do? All right. I went outside and I went for a walk around the block. I took a deep breath and I looked at nature, because one of the things in human society, we build things that are very linear. I mean, you can see my bookcases behind me and the door frame and the walls. It's all straight lines and linear, just like in a school or an office or a prison. Nature does not do that. Nature's all curved. Okay. Look at your tree. Look at a river. Look at rocks. Okay.
I love my tree.
So go walk, look at your tree, walk around. Okay. Because one, when you're getting a little bit of physical activity, the blood flows and it helps your brain clear out negative chemicals and reset. And it helps reset your attitude, but also the visual change of seeing different things, walking around, looking at the texture, maybe getting some wind on your face, feeling the sun, all that helps reset you in some ways. So I do that and I remind myself the why am I doing this? What is so important? I mean, like, as they say in The Princess Bride, when Miracle Max is trying to revive Wesley, you know, what you got to live for? Okay. Remind yourself, what is your mission? Because if you are that involved and that engrossed in your mission, then yeah, you're going to have bad days, but you're going to get yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep going.
You know, when I was, when I first started my career, I had a mentor and he gave me this advice, which has stuck with me for the last 40 years or so. And he said to me, Ari, always remember one thing. Those who know how will always, always, always work for those who know why.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Just brilliant. And that has stuck with me, you know, and that's how I've tried to model my life. You know, you got to know, you have to know the why. How we can always teach, but the why,
exactly.
You gotta know your why.
Or as I teach people, there's the skill set and the will set. Mm. Okay. And so your will set is informed by your why. Your why is your mission. Your will set is the guts, the determination. Mm-hmm. And you will get up at O-Dark 30 to train to develop your skills if the will is there. And the will comes from that why. As Muhammad Ali said, champions are not made in the ring. They're made in the dark before dawn. And that's what then ultimately comes into manifestation, what others can see. I mean, 6-year-old Cassius Clay was champion of the world in his mind.
Right.
It took him until he was 22 years old to actually win the title, youngest title holder ever at that point.
Right.
But he had that belief, that why, and then did the work around it. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger asked him, how many sit-ups do you do every day? And Muhammad Ali told Arnold Schwarzenegger, I don't know, I don't start counting until it hurts. Because he was that committed to doing what he did because of the vision.
So, so what are you doing now?
I'm sitting on my butt.
Oh, very smart. So you're basically, you're a coach,
advisor. I don't do much financial advising anymore. It's more working with advisors and agencies. So I'm basically helping develop these people, because it's a leverage play. I could go and I could help 30, 50 new clients a year on my own, or I can go and work with, you know, a couple dozen agencies and 30 or 40 individual reps, and they can each go help 30 to 50. And so instead of helping 50 families a year, I can reach 500 plus families.
Wow. I hear.
And that's one of the reasons why I end up writing the book, is because I think that through the book and podcasts like this and talking with individuals, I can actually reach out and help impact 10 million people a year.
Yeah. So that was going to be my next question. Tell us about the book that you wrote. What is it called?
It's called Everyday Excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's designed to be a multivitamin for life, because every single day we have all these different components of our life that we need to try and improve upon, where it's our communication, whether it's our occupation, physical health, mental health, nutrition, our families. So every single day, we're basically fighting entropy. The universe wants to make us worse over time, you know, because we get lazy, we're human, things mm-hmm. happen. So everyday excellence is designed to help people get better on multiple parameters on a daily basis, so that at the end of a week, month, year, we can be in a better position overall. I call it human Kaizen. Kaizen being the Japanese idea of continuous improvement that was applied to engineering and manufacturing. We can turn around and apply this to ourselves and our families, our occupation, our relationships, and ultimately put ourselves in a much better position.
Now, if you had to point to one person who had the most effect on you in your life, who would that be and why?
At different stages in our life, different people come into it that are important to us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for about a decade, it was my Taekwondo master, Danny Grant, who my mm-hmm. oldest kid's named after, because he was teaching me, you know, reinforcing the discipline and the guts and, you know, going beyond anything that you knew, working on your skill set. He also taught me to be a great communicator as an instructor. So for a while, it was that. For a long period, obviously, it was my mom, because she embedded in me the love of learning and the hard work. You know, growing up on the farm, if you don't work, you don't eat. So that translates mm-hmm. to the work ethic that I maintain to this day. For the past 10 years, it's been my dad being there to help guide and support me in a lot of ways. So there's no one person that I can say over my entire life, except my mom, because she obviously, you know, brought me into this world. And as she's always said, I can take you out and make another one look just like you. But I used to say, well, because I don't look like my brothers and sisters, because I'm tall and they're not. I'm like, well, my real mommy is a space princess, and someday she's going to come and get me. She's like, I'll help you pack. So that's the sort of relationship that I had with my mom. I got a flat spot in the back of my head from her going like this, and, you know, smacking me all the time. But one of the things that my mom taught me, and I've taught my kids, is she used to say, sometimes I love you, but I don't like you very much right now, when I was not making good choices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody asked us, her, which one of her kids was the favorite. And she's like, oh, I hate them all equally.
Yeah.
And so I tell my kids that, and my youngest actually responded, yes, but you love us all differently. And I think that is, you know, this is my autistic kid, incredible insight.
Right.
Because you need to, if you have multiple kids, they're different people. If you have multiple people work in your office, they're different individuals.
Absolutely.
You have people in your life, you love them differently as they need to be loved. And if you can adopt that mentality, you can actually go pretty far.
Wow. I think those are, you know, tremendous words of advice, tremendous words of wisdom, something that definitely my audience needed to hear. Now, if people want to get a hold of you, how would they do that? You have a website, you have email, do you have social media? Tell us how does one get in touch with Joe Templin?
So go to the website, which is everyday-excellence.com. There's a contact us button there. Also, I put up 4 or 5 microblogs per week. So little 1-2 minute quick hits that are out there to just help people out. You can follow me on Twitter or Facebook. Those are both at EDE with Joe. So at EDE for Everyday Excellence with Joe. And those are the best ways to turn around, find me, or you can just go to the local Irish pub. I might be sitting there.
There you go. All right. Very good. Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for coming on my show, sharing your story with my audience. I'm sure you've touched the hearts and minds of many of the people in my audience. Good luck going forward. Good luck with your kids. I'm sure they're going to do great things in their lives, especially with a dad like you. So the best of luck to you and your family. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Sharma. Remember, if you feel like you're stuck in the mud, like you're spinning your wheels, wasting time, your career, your business, your life, if you know you're not enjoying all the success, satisfaction, significance that you desire, then it's time for you to book a call with me at callwithari.com. Check out my Whispers and Bricks Coaching Academy. And until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks, and never, ever give up on your dreams. Bye for now.